I don't have a pencil, but I guess I need a pencil.
All right, this is Jody Roberts. I'm here with Glenn Schweitzer at the National Academies in Washington, D.C. Today is Wednesday, December 29th, 2010, and this interview is part of our Tusca Oral History Project. So thank you, Glenn, again for being with us. We just would like you to start with just some general background, your background in becoming a civil servant and, you know, working up to your time into getting towards the EPA in the early 1970s, but I know you had a lot of other experiences before that.
Well, why don't I just start with the ones that are just before I joined EPA.
Sure.
I had worked in the office of the vice president in the late 1960s, where I was on an organization called the Marine Science and Technology Council, and I reported through an intermediary to Vice President Humphrey. And in that position, I received a pretty good overview of what was going on in the marine area, including the environmental aspects of ocean problems. I was a career civil servant then. I had been in the Foreign Service, but I converted to a career civil servant. I then was offered a position in USAID to set up their Office of Science and Technology, which I did for 4 years. I was again a civil servant in that position, and I spent 4 years at USAID setting up the science office from scratch. And I hired staff, put new programs in place, administered projects around the world. In the early 70s, a colleague of mine who knew me from my experiences in the Vice President's office in USAID contacted me and said that EPA was setting up a new office for toxic substances. They needed a manager who had experience. He thought I was a good manager.
Do you remember who this was?
Barden. I don't know what his first name was. His name was Barden. But he worked in EPA. Charlie Barton. He said, why don't you apply for the job? So I applied for the job. I was one of 150 or so candidates applying for several jobs at EPA, and I was selected for the position to be the head of OTS. I was told I was not selected because I was a toxicologist, because I wasn't. I'm a mechanical engineer from Caltech. But I was selected because they needed someone who knew how to start programs, hit the ground running, and administer programs in a sound way.
So I just want to stop you real quick, if that's all right.
Sure.
I don't want to interrupt your flow. But could you talk a little bit more about your background in government administration and its relationship to science? It seems like that's a common thread with your previous experiences, how you got into those roles.
I was in the Foreign Service in the late 50s. I decided to resign from the Foreign Service to become an engineer. When the State Department found out about it, they said, you can't resign from the Foreign Service. We'll make you an engineer. You stay in the Foreign Service. So they sent me to Caltech for my master's degree on the grounds that the Foreign Service needed technical people. So I received my master's degree in engineering at Caltech. I specialized in nuclear engineering. The State Department then sent me to Argonne National Laboratory for 2 summers to write a book there on an experimental boiling water reactor, which I did. And then I went back to the State Department and was assigned to their Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. I was one of the first people in their science bureau of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency in the early 60s. In 63, in the meantime, I had learned Russian during my Army service, and I kept up with it pretty well. And then I was approached in the early 60s if I would go to Moscow and become the science attaché at the embassy in Moscow. They had never had a science attaché there before. They wanted somebody they could trust, and since I was a Foreign Service officer, they knew they could trust me. They wanted somebody who spoke English, and they wanted somebody who was energetic. So I went to Moscow for 3 years, And I set up the science office at the American Embassy in Moscow, which is still there all these years later. When I came back from Moscow, the State Department didn't exactly know what to do with me. They put me in their atomic energy office. But I was then recruited by someone from the vice president's office, whom I had only met once at a cocktail party, but he knew about me in Moscow. He knew about my record in Moscow. He said I was just the guy they needed in the vice president's office, and he persuaded me to go over to the vice president's office, where I stayed for a couple years and then resigned from the Foreign Service because having seen the big city, it's hard to go back to the farm. And I stayed in the vice president's office for 3 to 4 years on the Marine Science Council. Then I was recruited by EPA to compete for this position, and I won the competition. That's how I ended up at EPA. So I entered EPA in 73 as the first director of the Office of Toxic Substances, which didn't quite exist. And I was given 4 tasks by the leadership of EPA. Job one, I was to be the point man on the moving TSCA through the congressional process. The early drafts of TSCA had already been sent to the Hill a couple years earlier, and there was a pretty well attuned version up there in the Hill in 73 when I arrived at EPA. Secondly, I was to be the point person on the chemical of the month problems. And when these chemical of the months came up, they were referred to me, and I was supposed to do something about them. Thirdly, I was asked to assist the office, the air office and the water office in addressing toxics that they were trying to address under their various legislative authorities. And so I had a responsibility there to see the toxics were developed to the extent possible, or were addressed in a responsible way under the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. They had different names, the laws had different names at those times. And finally, I was asked to upgrade the data that was being used on toxic substances throughout the agency. There were lots of data banks around that were being drawn on. There were going to be new data banks generated by TSCA, and I was given the responsibility to address the data issue big time, particularly testing data. So those were the 4 substantive thrusts of what I was told I was supposed to do. These weren't exactly written out in the job description, but these were given to me as when I arrived. And then finally, I was to build the office. The office had about three or four people in it when I arrived, and they wanted to scale up. And I was reluctant to hire people until we really knew what they're going to do, because I didn't like people around with not enough to do. And so we scaled up gradually, but that was one of my jobs. So that was when I arrived. That was in 73. And then I stayed there till through 76, the law passed in the fall of 76. It failed in 74, and there was an interesting story why it failed in 74, but then it was reintroduced in 75, and in the fall of 76, it finally was signed by President Ford.
All right, so there's a lot of stuff to fill in there.
Yeah, and then in 77, when the Carter team came in, I remained there until June, when I was then removed from my position as head of OTS. So that's a very broad framework within which you may want to ask questions.
Yeah, there's lots of good stuff. So you gave us some sense of what the formal expectations were along those 4 priorities, and then the 5th being building up the office. Can you talk a little bit about what the informal expectations inside of the job were, or talk a little bit about the atmosphere inside of EPA when you got there?
The I have never been associated with the Democratic or the Republican Party. I was strictly a civil servant. But there were always stories circulating at the time EPA was set up that the Democrats were pro-environment and the Republicans were dragging their feet. And that the Department of Commerce was the Republican ally and so forth. I found those stories to be completely absurd. The people I worked with, both the political leadership and the civil servants in EPA, were gung-ho. I don't see how they could have been any more pro-environment. And so I was really surprised and obviously pleased to be on a team that really wanted to do something about the environment. And so there was never any attempt to throw roadblocks on what we were doing or what have you. And that just surprised me because of my shallow reading of the newspapers. I thought there may be some political twist to this. So that was one point I thought was important, that the administration that I worked for, it was really gung-ho to go in the environmental area, and particularly with Tosca. I think the expectations when I arrived was that Tosca was pretty far along, and that that a lot of the debates had already been held. The bridge had been crossed about whether there would be pre-manufacturing approval or pre-manufacturing notification. That was a done deal. The language had been worked out about whether it was unreasonable risk or acceptable risk. That was already set. The notion that small-scale companies had to have special consideration was in place. And I agreed with all those. I mean, I intuitively agree with them. I had some experience in the environment area in the vice president's office where we had addressed a lot of these issues, but not in the chemical-specific context. Mm-hmm. So I was quite pleased with this legislation that I was supposed to help get through the system. And so I was very cool with that. But there were extensive discussions with the Hill, particularly with OMB to a lesser extent. Department of Commerce had fallen out of the objecting mode. Even the OMB was supportive. By that time, CEQ wasn't playing a role. CEQ had done their thing. Terry Davis and company had crafted together the first instance, but they had turned it over to EPA, and EPA was where the action was. And the action came down from the administrator to the assistant administrator to me, and it was on my desk. There were four or five assistant administrators while I was there to whom I reported. So the assistant administrators they came and they went. The toxics was tucked under, was toxics, pesticides, water, and other people all together under one administrator. And the administrator was always a water person or a air person or something, and I was just one of the deputies. I don't know if I had the title deputy assistant administrator, but I was just one of the four offices that reported to an administrator. But in fact, at all the dealings with the Hill, I dealt either with Russ Train or John Quarles, and John Quarles particularly was much involved on the Hill.
And what position was he in?
He was the deputy administrator.
Okay.
And our interactions with the Congress were really on very, very small issues. There were no challenges to the major provisions that had been crafted together by the time I got there. I mean, everybody agreed there should be a testing provision. Everybody agreed there should be a regulatory provision, you know, manufacturing provision, a health effects reporting provision. These were all issues had been agreed to by 73. Mm-hmm. And there was grumbling from the industry and grumbling from the NGOs and about some of them, but basically it was over very minor details. I'll give you broad strokes and come back for specifics then. Secondly, on the toxic of the month, everybody agreed that needed attention. And there the idea was to use existing regulatory authority, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, authority of other agencies, Consumer Protection, Safety Commission, FDA, OPP, OSHA, whatever, to solve the problem. And we had a number of them. In one case, in the vinyl chloride case, we used arm twisting. We didn't have good authority in the vinyl chloride case. We did have it. We didn't have good authority to shut it down quickly enough, so we used arm twisting. But whatever the chemical of the month was, and I'm not sure they came out every month, but they may have been, while I was there, may have been a dozen cases over the couple of years, we were able to address it somehow solve the problem. And again, everyone in EPA wanted to solve the problem. I mean, sure, Dow Chemical might have been involved, but there weren't any fans of Dow Chemical saying to back off on Dow Chemical. No way. So they all wanted to solve the problem, and I was very energized by the whole activity. Now, the next one was a tough one, was to provide input on the toxics dimension of regulations under other authorities, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the drinking water legislation, whatever, authorities within EPA. My office really had a tough time. We were just outgunned. And we didn't bother us at all, but the water people could put a dozen people plus a lab on a problem. We had two people. So we took a very light touch there. Unless we really had something important to say, we didn't try to second guess these offices, which had dozens of people on the problem. And so I would say on that, we didn't make too much of an impact. Occasionally, we raised some issues on mercury or whatever that we didn't think we were getting enough attention. There was an organization called the Steering Committee in EPA, and I was a member of the Steering Committee, which all regulations had to go through the Steering Committee before they went to the administrator for sign-off. And I had a seat on that Steering Committee. And whenever there was a toxic problem being discussed at the Steering Committee, I was expected to weigh in and say something. But with a thin staff, this didn't happen that often that we needed a big staff, so we did make a little contribution there. I would say we didn't make too big a contribution, but we did make a big contribution. And there might have been a little bit of unhappiness of the other regulatory offices when we were commenting on their regulation. Nobody likes other people to comment on their regulation. And the general counsel's people maybe say, why are you guys commenting on this water regulation? But we only would comment if we had something to say. So I was very careful of that because we don't want to alienate the agency, which we needed their support for, because toxics got across everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was the omnibus for the whole federal effort. So we were aware of that. We were aware that we had to have everybody on board. And so we took it gently. Then the other responsibility we had was the databases. Well, where were the databases that were relevant? There were two kinds of databases. There was the monitoring databases, and then there were the toxicology epi databases we focused on. The monitoring database were basically in the 10 regions, and they were in terrible condition. People did not understand what was meant by standard deviation. They didn't understand the word standard deviation. So every piece of data in those databases should have had a standard deviation associated with it, but none of them did. They were all put in there as numbers, the 3 point per million. It should be three parts per million plus or minus something or other, but they never had the plus or minuses. So all the data all over the agency was sort of absolute data. You had no idea of the quality of the data. So you couldn't mix data sets and so forth. And so we started down the road on the monitoring data. Let's make sure now that we can, new data going into these databases all over the agency had standard deviations on them, because we were talking chemical specific data. And because they don't have standard deviations and there's not a tag on there on the quality, that data is not going to hold up in court. We knew that right from the start. One thing we did know something about was data. And I think we tried our best to get that across. Now, fortunately, 6-7 years later, when I was in Las Vegas, I was responsible for quality assurance in the East, so I was got my day in court. But so on the epidemiological and the toxicology data, that was a tough nut. Also, I did succeed. I hired a couple of toxicologists right away. The first thing I did was hire 3 or 4 toxicologists, which brought into our office. So everybody was trying to steal them from me all the time, but they stuck with me. And we did make a contribution to the debates on human risk assessment. We had a couple of good people there, both young people, and I had one very senior person. And we did, I think, help the agency better understand what toxicology is all about, what risk assessment is all about, and so forth. As a matter of fact, the ORD was constantly saying that my group of toxicologists should be transferred to them. And bureaucratically, I decided that wasn't a very good idea, so maybe he said, oh, you got to transfer those guys to us because this is our job. So maybe I should have, but we didn't. On the epidemiological data, I must say, we only had a staff of a dozen people or 20 people. We're talking a small operation here, but it was better than 100 people, hundreds of people we now have. We at least did something. We didn't write memos to each other all the time. On the epidemiological data, we didn't have anybody on our staff that really understood that, including myself. And we started talking with the people in, HHS, was it HHS then, or I don't know whether they had combined with Health and Human Services, or there was a reorganization of that department. But anyway, the people who worked for what is now HHS, we had constant meetings with them. They had a research institute down at RTP, a fellow named Dave Rawl they had working for them, who was really, really good in this field. So, but in the whole epidemiology area, I must say, in my time, I don't think we covered ourselves with glory. We did get involved in trends in cancer in various areas of the country versus presence of chemicals in various areas of the country. And it came in when there was a terrible problem in New Orleans, when the rivers down there were polluting or whatever, and we were trying to correlate cancer rates in different parishes there versus the chemical monitoring level, so forth. What we did, we sort of became aware of the difficulties in dealing with epidemiological data. So those are the four areas. So that's the general broad brush of those four areas we tried to address.
Oh, you want to dig into each one of those?
Pardon?
You want to dig into each of those maybe in turn?
Now, one other thing I want to say, though, sure. I think it's important. The first thing I asked when I went there was, what is our objective? Mm-hmm. And it took about 5 minutes to figure out what our objective was. Our objective was to prevent and reduce exposure to dangerous chemicals. It was very clear to me. And I was not a specialist in this area, but it wasn't that tough to figure out.
Was that answer given to you, or was that something you developed?
Oh, we figured out ourselves. I mean, I had 3 or 4 people when I went there. We said, what are we trying to do? Everybody said, oh, putting out regulations. I said, well, why are we putting out these regulations? I said, I want a nice, clear concept of what are we trying to do? And they said, okay, we're going to try to prevent and reduce exposure to dangerous chemicals. That's our job. How are we going to do that? And we have, oh, we're going to, this regulation. I said, how's the government going to do that? And we're going to lead the way. And the answer was, well, we have all these regulatory authorities all over the government. And we've got all this, all these states out there which want to get in the act. We've got the industry itself, which have environmental conscience. We have the public out there. And we want to use whatever the best tool it is to do that. Now, if it's part of TSCA, that's great. But remember, TSCA is the law of last resort.
Was it always that way, or was it that way?
That was the way it was written when I arrived. Tosca said, if you can do, you can solve the problem cheaper some other way, do the other way. So that was the message from Tosca. It was the law of last resort. If you can solve the problem with the Clean Water Act, the Clean Water Act takes precedence.
So, was that something that was immediately obvious when you got there, or was that something that became obvious through your interactions with other people at EPA?
You just had to read the law.
But the law wasn't done yet, right?
No, but it was the proposed law. It was the proposed law. Mm-hmm. And also, without the law, it had to be the last resort. It wasn't. I mean, you had to go to other agencies. But that was the idea in the law, and since there was no law, we had to use these other authorities because we couldn't have anything else. And so that was... So thinking, and also we thought the law was going to pass in 94, very frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, all my colleagues in EPA and around the government thought it was going to go through until the Sierra Club got involved, but they made a terrible mistake. But so we were maybe thinking a little narrow, but we thought, okay, now and when the TSCA is in place, now we have to go without TSCA, but when it's in place, we'll have the whole thing covered because TSCA can do anything that other people can't do. I mean, there was no limitation on TSCA if other people couldn't do it. So I think that's important. So I said, okay, if we're going to reduce the exposure, we're going to prevent reduced exposure to toxic chemicals, we have to know what the exposure is. Mm-hmm. And so there, right from the so the people said, oh, it's what the industry dumps. So I said, okay. So I said, what the industry does. So I said, okay. So I spent 4 years visiting industry. I went all over this country visiting all the chemical companies, big and small, seeing what, you know, what are you guys doing, and trying to, at least before TSCA was passed, jawboning and say, you know, we've got to pay attention, you've got to clean up that, you got to stop dumping your stuff there. So I visited, I don't know, maybe 25 or 30 companies. I mean, and a visit wasn't a two-hour visit. I mean, a visit was a couple days. Hmm. I mean, I didn't fly to St. Louis to Monsanto for a two-hour visit. So I went to all these places, and it turns out that a good thing I did it, because once the law was in place, the lawyers got very nervous about my going out there. They thought, you know, I'd be conned. But since we didn't have a law, it was, you don't have any conflicts there because you don't have a law to administer. Mm-hmm. So, fine, go ahead. So just don't take free meals from them.
So what was it like to run an office that didn't have a law behind it yet?
EPA had a tremendous amount of clout. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, and people were nervous about the law coming down the pike. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are CNE News, for example, would carry features on this sucker every month, even though the law wasn't in place. Mm-hmm. So people knew it was dead serious. And the amount of bucks involved, I think we were talking hundreds of millions of dollars, the numbers we were using. There was a very famous tiff we had with Dow estimating the cost of implementing TSCA, and they'd come up with $500 million, and we'd come up with $200 million, and my job was to go talk to Dow and see if we could get a compromise. So, but the numbers were big. Mm-hmm. And the chemical industry, at least big chemical, maybe not the little guys, but the big guys took this very seriously. Mm-hmm. That the Chemical Manufacturers Association, usually called, it has a new name, Chemical Council or something.
The American Chemistry Council.
They were very serious about this. Mm-hmm. So, granted, they took my colleague who administered the Clean Water Act more seriously than they took me, but they didn't say, get lost, you have no clout.
What about internally in the rest of the agency? So you're being asked to work with these other offices, figure out ways to collaborate, but you don't have any statutory authority yet.
We had to come in with scientific information they could use. And some of those guys, they're busy, don't bother us. And most program managers would say that. Yeah, look, if you have something to offer, come drop it on my desk. Mm-hmm. But they've got a task force doing that reg and a task force doing that reg. They got enough bureaucratic things to go through. So I was aware of that. So I tried to be a nice guy. And I only bothered them when I had something specific I thought they'd be interested in.
But as a framework that was supposed to be an umbrella law,
yeah,
how was that hindered or made more difficult through these interactions because you didn't actually have a law that you were representing yet?
Well, I until the law passed, I never pretended we were operating under a law. I said, look, you know, we know something about toxics, and here I'll help you, sort of thing, rather than. I didn't sense much of a problem. I wasn't trying to take over their jobs at all. That's why I kept the staff small, very frankly. I didn't want to get in other people's pockets. And when I left there, we had, 40, 50 people. Now they're complaining they only have 300 or 400. Well, what do they need? 300 or 400 people writing memos to each other. I didn't see a problem. I didn't see a problem with that. Also, I think the agency kind of liked me. They knew I didn't have these deadlines to get these regs out, so they figured I had more time, so I could go around and talk to OSHA. That's good. Just tell them I could go down and talk to the state of North Carolina or whatever, and that's good. We got to find out what they're doing. So I was doing things that they thought were interesting.
So talk to me a little bit about the relationship between the office as you're setting it up and what you see TSCA eventually doing. So if you take your objective, which is very concise, prevent and reduce exposure to dangerous chemicals, you don't necessarily need TSCA to do that.
Yes, you do.
But you were doing it without it.
Well, we were doing half a job. TSCA would have given us the able to do a lot better.
Right, right.
I mean, we were just we were just nibbling at the.
So, what did TSCA enable you to do that you weren't able to do while you were simply waiting for it?
What enabled the agency to do? Okay, because I was gone.
Sure.
But certainly, Section 6. Now, people all complain about, asbestos killed Section 6, but I don't think they understand Section 6. Mm-hmm. Section 6 isn't limited to banning things. Mm-hmm. Section 6 thing says you can put labels on things. Mm-hmm. And you can go over and talk to the Department of Transportation and say, hey, you're going to put labels on this. If they say no, so we're going to put it on TSCA. They say, yes, well, go ahead. Section 6 says you can control hazardous wastes. There were the RCRA hadn't kicked in fully, and Superfund hadn't kicked in. Mm-hmm. But Section 6 says you could regulate hazardous wastes. Section 6 gave you blanket authority to do almost anything you want to do with chemicals. So that was the driver. The pre-manufacturing, Section 4, I guess it was. Pre-manufacturing, you can chop off any of those on pre-manufacturing. Mm-hmm. You got to make a case and do it, but that's a clout. The testing, you could require people to test, and the requirement for testing was a lot weaker than the requirement for banning under 6. And as a matter of fact, you could put the so you could do a lot of things that. Mm-hmm. With TSCA in place. And if under Section 5, I guess it was the testing, I'm not sure of the numbers, I think it's Section 5, you could go to the industry and say, look, here's a chemical that you're putting out in 5,000 tons a week. How? You can either test that starting tomorrow, or we're going to put out a regulation and test it. You'll test it our way starting in 2 years, but you'll test it our way instead of your way. And that has a lot of clout. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any question that TSCA gave you the muscle if you want to do things. But I really like the language in the law that says it has to be an unreasonable risk. I like the idea of balancing economics and science and environment. People complain, they're too tough a test to see if you could really regulate something. Well, if you can't make the case that you can't make a cost-benefit case, you probably shouldn't be doing it. Mm-hmm. That was always my end. Now, of course, I wasn't around when they developed some of these regs, but they got in trouble with the courts. But in those days, my attitude was, that language seems reasonable. Mm-hmm. We tried very hard to figure out, in discussions with the Congress, we went through all those words. We tried to figure out better formulations of the regulatory provisions. Unreasonable risk was one area, and there were variations on the theme. Mm-hmm. But very frankly, we couldn't come up with better formulations, which really balanced the national interest. I mean, we were the Environmental Protection Agency, not the Economic Protection Agency. But still, as the Environmental Protection Agency, you had to worry about the economics, or it made no sense. I mean, no, asbestos, should you ban asbestos? Well, we wanted at least, without TSCA, we were trying to limit it under the Clean Water Act, because when they detected asbestos in the Schuylkill River in Philadelphia, we sent people up there and were sort of fishing for asbestos in that river, and it seemed like, and then we had tests on the asbestos, and it seemed to me in those days, this was before TSCA kicked in, that we should have been doing something with asbestos under the Clean Water Act, but we never did. But these things don't happen. It takes time to work some of these mm-hmm. out.
So you said you were a fan of the language of unreasonable risk when it was going through in the Congress back in the 70s.
Yeah.
How do you feel like that played out?
I don't really know. Very frankly, on the asbestos case, all I know is what Chuck Elkins says. He says, we goofed it by not... Chuck Elkins says, we blew it by not appealing. Mm-hmm. And I have great confidence in Chuck. He must have good reason for that, because he was in the driver's seat part of that time. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the details. I didn't get involved in that one at all. I got involved in a couple. They came around and subpoenaed me several times after I left the agency on issues that came up, but not that one.
Yeah. So it would seem that one of the underpinnings for the unreasonable risk clause playing out is that you've got to have access to good data. You need to have enough data to be able to make right. that judgment.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about how you thought, you've pointed out already how some of the, there's a serious lack of good data, if any data at all, in some of the things that you mentioned. How were you working through trying to fill in some of those data gaps? What sort of data did you want? And what kind of data did you think you needed in order to support something like being able to meet the challenge of unreasonable risk?
Well, I thought 8E was a very key provision. And I heard Owen say 8E didn't work. I don't know what he meant. But 8E says that if anybody knows that there's a health effect of a chemical that's bad, you got to tell EPA, something like that. And then people get all hung up, well maybe it's some secret chemical. They don't want to tell you what it is because it's industrial proprietary and so forth. But I always thought that the people who were most likely to have adverse effects data were the people who manufactured the stuff or used the stuff, and they would be the 8E people. So I always thought that was a terribly important provision. The notion that EPA is going to go around and test 70,000 chemicals or something like that, or 7,000 or 700 or 70 chemicals, I said, boy, somebody's been smoking pot. It just seemed to me that this wasn't a central command and control economy we're living in, where you do everything under the central. You had to have all those people out there helping you out, and then when they help you out, they find something bad, they got to tell you, or else they go to jail. I thought that was a very logical approach, mm-hmm. and I was, I don't know if you, when the Chemical Association set up that testing laboratory in North Carolina. They set up a toxicology testing lab there. That was terrific, and I was a big supporter of that, because here the industry was going to take a lot of nasty chemicals and test them, potentially suspect chemicals and test them. And I knew the government had to have a kind of a watchdog look at it to make sure they're doing it properly. But that was so much more sensible than EPA mm-hmm. getting going out with a regulation saying we're going to test this thing, and then going through all the hearings. People say you can't test, you can't, and then having farming out to either an EPA lab or a contractor to test it, go through all that paperwork, and come back 6 years later with the test results. This shortcut that the chemical industry was proposing, I don't know if it's still going or not, I thought that was a terrific way to go. And I think too many, I didn't consider us to be the the pilot of every train. Mm-hmm. I considered us to be more the guys in the switchyard who had our own trains to send up, but who also had influenced lots of other trains going out. And that was what I thought. That's why I thought this law was such a terrific law.
Well, so there's two pieces to the data question. One is getting access to data that might already exist. So being able to get those who are already manufacturing these chemicals to offer up the information that they already have in-house. And yeah. I think from other people that we've talked to for this project, that was definitely one of the major considerations in the ways in which the law was structured, that you know these people are doing at least some testing, they ought to share it. Which so that leads us in some ways.
But they only have to share it if there's adverse health effects.
Right.
They don't have to share it if it's neutral. If it's
right. So that does get us into the question of how do you know there are adverse health effects if you don't know that there are, if you don't have access to the data.
So if you find out, then they can go to jail. There were some cases. There were some cases way back in my time. Companies had not brought their data to the front, and somehow it's discovered later on a whistleblower or something, and then got in big time trouble with the legal system.
But it assumes a certain honesty on the part of all parties, rather than
honesty. Or if they don't honesty, if they get caught, then they go to jail.
But getting caught usually involves you only get caught after there's been some sort of.
That's right. The whistleblowers are sort of somebody died, and then you're caught.
Right.
That's right.
So there seems to be, it seems like, at least around current discussions now in trying to think about what holes need to be plugged, figuring out how to get access to that data sooner before there's a problem or hold people responsible for being honest and sharing that information seems to be a catch in there. And so
heavy penalties if they don't share the data. Mm-hmm. But you know, I don't want to bankrupt our economy. I want chemicalist does good things.
Sure.
And I'm very sympathetic to their position on protecting IPR and so forth. That's mm-hmm. that's their lifeblood. And so, if DuPont or Union Carbide or somebody says, gee, if this gets out, we're going to lose that market. I don't want the Japanese taking over the market. So I'm sympathetic to that.
Mm-hmm. So there are questions. I mean, I was going to say, so this does lead down into the questions around confidential business information and what ought to count as confidential business information and what's actually a secret and what's necessary for protecting a trade secret versus what ought to be transparent and publicly available in terms of health data. The large murkiness in between that EPA is trying to navigate, because they can see inside of that CBI, but they also need to be able to share some of that information. But the other, I think that you hint at and that you discuss a little bit more in your book, is not simply a missing data, but really not even having a scientific and technical infrastructure that could give you the data that you want. And I wonder if you might talk a little bit about that from your time there, that you might not even have, there isn't just simply a lack of testing that's been done, but an uncertainty about what sort of testing ought to be done, the type of instrumentation that's necessary to do these sorts of things. And if you could talk a little bit about, if this is at all relevant, how you tried to fill those gaps during those years that you were at OTS, recognizing that we don't really have the analytical capabilities to do the sorts of testing that we might like to have in order to make these sorts of assessments.
Well, you're talking primarily about toxicological data, aren't you? Human health effects data.
Sure.
Well, the
but not exclusively.
What was done in my day was they set up this interagency testing committee. Was I don't know if that was in the law or not. Was it in the law, or was it just something we did?
I believe it was just something you did.
I felt that in the when it came to human health effects, if the human health Human Health and HHS weighed in, and CDC weighed in, and FDA weighed in, EPA was going to lose. Because EPA was not a health agency. Mm-hmm. And I had testified enough with doctors to know that you don't get an argument in front of the Congress with a doctor sitting next to you, because the doctor is going to win every time. I was quite comfortable with the idea that if we at EPA could identify the chemicals that seem to be suspect, that this interagency testing committee, which would be able to figure out as well as anybody what kind of tests could be carried out to resolve the issues of whether the chemical was dangerous and how dangerous it was. At the time, I thought it was kind of a waste of time to try to prioritize 60,000 chemicals, or how many there are now, 75,000 chemicals, in any kind of a very tightly structured. I thought the way to go was to try to, if there were some ripe fruit on the tree that needed picking, if there were some obvious in the top, if they're in the top, if you could pick 10, 20, 50 chemicals which were among the most important ones, for that was okay. You don't have to get every one. So, and I thought EPA would be pretty good with our people we had in being able to consult with the associations and everybody else and sort of identify whether is printer's ink really a difficult issue. And I thought, and we said, yeah, printer's ink deserves attention. But the kind of attention it deserves, I thought we had to really defer in large measure to these health guys who this is their business. Dyes, it seemed to us, were a really important thing. We got to worry about, I guess, called benzidine dyes or something. There are a whole raft of them coming out of Buffalo up there with the Germans or somebody set up a big dye industry there. And there was enough evidence around that shows they were bad actors. But now, how do you determine how bad they were, which ones were bad, whatever? I think we could play a role. I really thought that the HHS people really had to be out front. We had to keep them focused because these doctors sometimes are fuzzy and they're all over the lot. But you know, we were very focused. But I thought working with them, we could figure it out. So I don't think we didn't try to, at least in my day, we didn't try to go down the road too far in trying to specify just what kind of tests would be appropriate. And we didn't contract out any testing at all. We weren't doing any testing in those days. At first, there was no money, and secondly, that was early in the game. So I'm not sure that answers your question, but I guess we didn't. I think since I've left there, people have already walked over these issues many times, and I think I thought through much more deeply than I have. But I think the general approach is still, I don't see how it's changed. I haven't heard much that says it's changed. Mm-hmm.
So you bring up another issue during that answer, which is this tension between EPA as a health-based agency and an environmental protection agency. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about those tensions in setting up the Office of Toxics?
Every time we hired a toxicologist, people got nervous. Within the agency, ORD said it was theirs, and HHS said, you know, we're going to do the toxicology. So, but my view was we needed toxicologists right in the middle of it to make sure we farm something out to somebody else, we know what we're farming out, and B, to know what we do to do something with the results. So that the toxicology one was probably the most contentious issue along. Nobody would, almost, in the environmental effects, Fish and Wildlife had some capability, NSF said they had some capability, but right down to it, EPA was as good as anybody, I thought. Our lab in Athens, our lab in Oregon, our fish lab in Nantucket, and our fish lab in a place called Gulf Breeze. I thought that on the ecological side we were okay. We could take the lead, and we'd invite and NSF could come along and pitch in and so forth, and the fish people could pitch in, and and the other people who know something about the birds and so forth could pitch in. But on the human health one, I was among the skeptics. In fact, I really had to put the reins on some of our toxicologists who wanted to sort of change the world on their own. I said, gee whiz, you know, you may be right, but I'd feel much more comfortable if the guy, if those people at NIH would tell me we're on the right track, you know. So that was just my personal sense was that we had to be careful when we got into the health area. Okay. Turned out, came back when I went out to EPA and at the EPA lab in Nevada in 80, my team was called to Gulf Canal, and I deployed people to Gulf Canal for 2 years. And I had to testify in front of the city council on Gulf Canal, what's the danger? And so I went up there, and I went with a guy from, what's it called, the Toxics Registry down at CDC. Mm-hmm. So he and I went side by side, and we went up and testified in front of the city council with, we each had a sheriff escort because it was kind of dangerous. And when he spoke, he said, I'm Dr. So-and-so, I've had 30 years experience in internal medicine, whatever. There was an absolute hush all over them. No, he said, in my professional judgment, these people aren't in danger. But in the long run, we have to be careful. You know, and he was. And then I spoke. You're asking me if there's synergism between those two pollutants in the water. Well, our data shows that. And you know, I was sort of a laughingstock at this. I couldn't compete with this guy.
Yeah.
So, I don't try to compete with generals or doctors. You're going to lose every time. That was my lesson.
Yeah. So let's go back, if it's all right, to
sure.
Your categories, because you've filled in two of the four, I think. But I want to talk a little bit about more your time shepherding Tusca through Congress.
Okay.
Can you talk a little bit about the differences between dealing with the House and dealing with the Senate?
I thought that was pretty well worked out by the time I got there, very frankly. I think those battles were in the earlier 70s. When we testified in front of we interacted a lot with the staffs. The staffs were really pretty good on both sides. The House particularly had a good staff. And so usually, the usual routine was John Quarles and I would go up. We were usually obviously the lead testifier, and I'd be with him to support him. And I think both sides, you were lucky if you got one or two members sitting up there listening. It wasn't a priority topic. And I would say I didn't have much. We had more controversy over the chemicals of the month than we did when they got down to a very specific ketone in Virginia or hexachlorobenzene in Louisiana or PBBs in Michigan. Then the congressman got more interested. But in Tusca General, it wasn't a very, very intensive interaction there over those last 2 years, the 2.5 years that we dealt with the Congress. It was
Do you get the sense there was more intensity before?
Well, when I was at your meeting over at AAAS, mm-hmm. AAAS, there was a guy there who said he was on the Senate staff. Mm-hmm. He talked about what he was doing in 71. Mm-hmm. Well, that was 2 years earlier. Mm-hmm. And apparently 71, 72, there were some real hassles up on the Hill. Mm-hmm. But by the time I got there, those hassles had more or less disappeared. And I can't recall any incident of major restructuring of that law mm-hmm. when I was there. Now, for some reason, I don't know why the environmentalists were so. There were some environmentalists who were negative about the law. It was never clear what they wanted in addition to what was in there. They always kept coming back. They wanted to have the pesticide. Some of them wanted to have the pesticide model where you had to approve every new chemical. But in the last analysis, that never went anywhere, and they. They always wanted this item you're talking about is about more transparency for the world. Oh, and there was another item they wanted, which I think we added in. When EPA has hearings on an issue, EPA is required to pay the expenses for NGOs to come and testify. And I don't know if that was in there, but some language was inserted in there so that if there was a hearing and some NGO in Colorado didn't have money to come, they'd buy them the airplane. We'd have to buy them the airplane ticket, which I that's fine. But there was no, I just can't recall a big split between the House and the Senate by the time I got there.
So if it's your sense that most of the major issues had been resolved by the time you get there, what is it that's happening over the next 2 years before it actually passes?
First of all, there were some minor disagreements on these words specifically. One of the big job was to get time on the calendar of the Hill for the committee to get its act together and focus on it. Well, just getting time. The same way with OMB was getting them to focus on any unresolved issues. Even though there weren't unresolved issues, sometimes you had to go through OMB to get them to sign off on next steps and that sort. Every time you send something to the Hill, even for a minor change, you'd sort of have to get their occurrence. So very frankly, during that time I was there, most of the action was on these ad hoc problems that came up. For example, we published one set of regulations while I was still there. We published the chlorofluorocarbon regulations. Mm-hmm. And that was, we published three regulations at exactly the same time. These were draft regulations. In about March, I think, of 77, we had Consumer Protection Safety Commission was there, FDA was there, and OPP, our pesticides office, was there, and we were the brokers. I was the chair of the committee. And we got all three of those agencies to write parallel regulations on controlling CFCs. And we put them all out at the same time in the same Federal Register and others. That was a real, real triumph. Now, we didn't have to invoke TSCA because these were only on aerosols. We didn't. TSCA would have covered refrigerators. But these were on aerosols. Mm-hmm. And the aerosol regulations went out, and the TSCA role was sort of indication that TSCA was going to address the refrigerator problem. But that was a triumph for the agencies working together. And that was just before I left, we were able to get those out on the Federal Register. And then we had the vinyl chloride problems. These were 6-month problems. We had, when you have 15 vinyl chloride plants around the country spewing stuff onto the porches of the neighbors living around the plants, and these are all low-income neighbors, that becomes a big deal. And to use the Clean Air Act to shut them down, we could do two things. We could shut them down instantly. There was something in the Clean Air Act said you could shut down the plants tomorrow, some emergency provision. And there was another provision that said you could go through an expedited procedure and shut them down about 2 years. Well, we thought polyvinyl chloride was pretty important. In the United States, it's very important. So we rejected the idea of shutting the plants tomorrow on emergency, on, I guess, economic grounds. But we couldn't wait 2 years. So we got the CEOs from 15 companies to come in and agree to cut the emissions by, I don't know, 80% or something. In 3 months they did. So that was a big deal. We had the whole PCB thing was a constant problem. Every day you woke up, there was some other PCB problem, some other transformer had sprung a leak or whatever. And then the flammable to your pajamas, they're putting some of that chemical in the pajamas to present to catch the baby's bottoms on fire. And to get CPSC to do that was a big deal. We were getting ready for the regulations. Mm-hmm. We had really addressed the we had to put out a list of existing chemicals. It was a big deal. Mm-hmm. What's an existing chemical? And we had to go hassle through. That took a few months.
So talk about that a little bit. What was your approach to building an inventory?
Well, first we went to the ACS, which has the inventory of 3 million chemicals that exist in any herb been reported. Everybody has to report a new chemical to the ACS. So then we said, okay, well, that's all right now. We aren't going to take a chemical that's produced in 1 gram quantities. So then we had to figure what would be a cut point. And I've forgotten what 1,000 pounds a year, whatever the cut point was, I've forgotten. And then that, of course, was enormous discussions with the industry. And finally, there was an agreement that with the big companies, because it affected big companies primarily, that there would be a cut point at something where it came out 60,000 or 65,000 chemicals, whatever the number was. And then we had to define what each of those chemicals were. It had to be very clear. And fortunately, the ACS has a catalog of all these chemicals, which very clearly tells you what they are. But there were some variations on the theme. Then it was simply running that list through lots of people, and then there was grave concern we'd miss some. And so we were asking people if we missed some. So by the time the law was enacted, we had pretty well scoped out the inventory pretty well. And so I thought there were some details, but that was pretty well to go. And I think it took about two and a half years to get that out, I think.
After Tusco was
passed. Yeah, Cindy right. Kelly put that out. Mm-hmm. She was with me, and we were already ready to do that.
So the database was already under construction, or you had figured out the methods for how you were going to do it?
What do you mean by the database? No, we hadn't hired a...
But you didn't actually have an inventory. You had an idea of how you were going to build
that's
your
right.
inventory.
We hadn't hired the software engineers to figure out exactly how they're going to keep mm-hmm. them in catalogs and that sort of thing. That's mm-hmm. right. So that seemed to us to be a easily doable deal. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you about a month after the TSCA, a month into the new administration, TSCA passed in September. A month after the Carter people came to town. People want to know what we're going to do about TSCA. So we organized over at the Department of Commerce auditorium, or some big auditorium, a meeting. And we invited the world. And I had a briefing on how EPA planned to proceed in each of the areas, Section 4, Section 5, Section 6, Section. I had all these view graphs up there. And we invited questions from the audience. And then, not there weren't very many. We got a lot of kudos. But then when the new administration came in, they said, we're starting over again.
So talk about that. Talk about the transition, if you will.
It was a disaster.
In what way?
Well, the Democrats said the Republicans couldn't do anything right, and so therefore we're going to do it from scratch. Mm-hmm. We're going to do it our own way. And I, of course, was right in the middle of it. We have to start over.
But you were in a staff position at this time, right? You weren't a political appointee.
No, I was never a political appointee.
Right.
And I was told there would be a new assistant administrator come in who would take this over, so I should have just not make too much noise. The one briefing I had with Doug Costell, I guess, was the administrator. He came in. And I was asked to, I guess he was going through all the regulatory authorities, and he came to TSCA, and the issue was he asked a very sensible question: how do we regulate? How are we going to regulate TSCA's under various authorities? And we had a hit list of 10 or 12 chemicals or classes of chemicals that we thought were near the top of the list. And I had this list of 10 or 20 chemicals, and I went up and met with them for about an hour and said, "Here are the various chemicals we have, and here are some ideas that we can address this one under." Clean water, this one under RCRA or whatever, and I walked through them one by one, and he said, yes, thank you, and that's the last I ever heard. It's the last substantive interaction I had with the new administration.
But was there, so I'm sure there's got to be more details in there somewhere, but if you could talk about, there had to be some overlap if you didn't leave until spring of 77 or so.
And Warren Murray and Jelinek didn't come until August.
But there was, Jelinek was in office, but was in place.
No, they joined APA in August.
Of 77?
77. I was there till June of 77.
Mm-hmm.
And they came in August. And there was a fellow named Kent Johnson, who was the regional administrator from Boston, who was there sort of holding down the fort till they got there.
Mm-hmm. So where did you go after you left OTS?
I went to Cornell for 2 years. They told me to get lost.
And what were you doing up at Cornell?
Well, I was in there. They had a system they called IPAs. You know what the IPAs are? Well, they send people to universities and bring people in from universities. That was a convenient way to push me somewhere where I wouldn't cause trouble. One thing I did do that was relevant. I said, okay, when I was doing Tosca, I always thought that the job was to reduce exposures. So I'm going to go back to visit those companies I visited when I was EPA, see what difference it makes. And so I went back and visited some of those companies that I visited when I was at OTS. The difference was enormous, absolutely enormous. You wouldn't have believed it.
Hmm.
But I went into these various companies, Allied Chemical or Roman Haas or American Cyanamid, or back to Dow or DuPont and all those. I sort of addressed the same issues I had addressed 5 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It was absolutely amazing. For example, I always asked, how often does your board of directors or whatever they called address this issue? Back originally maybe once a year, and this time it was sort of every month. How big a staff do you have to watch this kind of chemical problem? When I went the first time, it was, well, we have one or two people. Here we have, we have 10 or 20. What kind of testing do you do? We don't have any labs, so we don't do any testing, some of them said. We have contracts with this university to do our testing. It was an absolutely enormous difference. So all I'm saying is that from 73 to 77, the time I was in EPA, I mean at OTS, I'm not the person who takes sole credit for this, but there was a big-time transition from lack of concern to mega-concern.
Mm-hmm. Did anyone in the new OTS ever get in touch while you were up at Cornell to, you know, questions about what they were going to do at Tusca, or was there any interaction at all?
No.
And so you're up at Cornell, but then you do come back to EPA.
Right.
After that, and head out to Nevada.
Right.
You want to talk just a little bit about that?
Well, I came back. I had this career appointment. They couldn't dump me.
Right.
And I have a family to feed. I mean, I'm not a wealthy person. So I spent 2 years in Cornell. That was the deal. And I came back, and here I am. I called the personnel people. Here, I'm where do I go? They said, okay, we're signing you to ORD. So they signed me to ORD. And I was given a slot in ORD, it was a legitimate slot. But the people in ORD knew me. And I had a pretty good reputation. I mean, they thought a lot of me. And so I wasn't coming back to a hostile environment at all. And then just after I arrived back, maybe a month or two, they had made big time riff out at Las Vegas, and they said we really need somebody to go out there and put that place back together again, torn apart. They had a fire, a dozen, 15 people or something, and cut their budget way back. So they said, would you do that? So I took a trip to Las Vegas and looked around and said, yeah, I'll do it. So they sent me out there, and I spent 5 years. And we put the place back together. We quadrupled the budget and got them back in business. So. So I wasn't really involved in Tosca, but I was much involved in monitoring. We had all the hard problems. We had acid drain, they call us. We had to send trailers all over the east, northeast United States to monitoring all the lakes in the northeast United States. Love Canal, we had to send our team up there. Three Mile Island, we had to send teams there for 2 years. Dallas lead smelter problems. We sent teams down there. Dioxin, Missouri, we sent teams there. So I had sort of teams all over the country. Damn, there was a problem. Somebody would call Las Vegas. Got to worry about nuclear bombers at the Los Angeles Olympics. So Ann Gorsuch and I became good friends. No, good acquaintances, not friends. Good acquaintances.
So go ahead.
That's fine. So, but that didn't have much to do with Tosca.
Yeah.
I deliberately stayed away from Tosca because I just felt that I thought it was a pretty tough job myself. I said the last thing they need is some has-been nitpicking what they're doing. So I dealt with the Clean Water Act people primarily, the Clean Air Act, and the Superfund work. At Las Vegas, we had the responsibility for quality assurance for chemical measurements. Because EPA guys were testifying in court all the time and getting chopped apart because the lawyers know how to get at you when you're presenting measurements. So we had a big time program on that, how to make measurements and how to be able to defend them in court. And the acid rain thing was a disaster. All that data collected by all those environmental luminaries fell apart when you looked at it carefully. So we had to go sample ourselves, and we flew helicopters. It was kind of fun, though. It was a good time. So that's my story.
That's your whole story?
My whole story.
So what do you think would have happened if Tusk had actually passed in 74? Do you think that would have made much of a difference?
Yes.
What would have been different?
There wouldn't have been this effort to divorce. There wouldn't have been this Democrat-Republican split. Now, maybe I exaggerate that because I was the guy they split in half. I think it would have rolled in right nicely, and maybe I would still be there, I don't know. And I think we would have, because Quarles and Russ Train were fully committed to this. I mean, it wasn't just me going. I mean, they were committed. I wasn't going out there up the hill on my own or going over and be on my own. They were always with me, and that was going to be their legacy. I mean, so I think if it had gone through, and what really went through was much different. It was kind of like 99.5% the same. Maybe there was a word or two changed, but not much. When it didn't pass in 74, I think some of the stakeholders out there didn't know if it was for would ever pass, and they may not have taken it very seriously, particularly the small chemical guys, and the states. I think the states were ready to move in 74. When it didn't pass, I think some of the states started to lose interest. So I just think there would have been a bigger celebratory event in terms of we're going to conquer the environment problem. By the time 76 rolled around, the states had felt left down. Some of them had their own toxic substance legislation, particularly Illinois and California. And must have been 15 states had legislation. And they were ready to go. And then it didn't happen. They felt a little left down. The industry, I think the industry also was really primed to go. And I don't know if it would have made any difference on the safety of the environment, the people or not. But also internationally, we picked up a lot of momentum in OECD. And then when we backed off, that whole OECD effort sort of stumbled along. I think we would have gotten the freons much earlier on CFCs. I don't know if we would have had any better luck with Section 6. I think the people in Section 6 were looking for a kill. They weren't looking at the small things you could do. I always thought that was wrong. I thought, I knew that banning something, now we weren't talking about banning asbestos in my time. We were talking about controlling otherwise. But I always had the sense when you banned an important chemical, it was going to be a hell of a problem. It was. But after seeing what the... But I thought small steps could be taken. I think I thought the labeling, I thought some of the handling provisions. And in fact, I heard from Owen, they're trying to do small steps under Section 6 now for the first time. But I remember up at American Cyanamid, they were telling me, you know, we can do a lot of things better with these chemicals. We don't have to ban them. We can just handle them better. We can you have requirements for if you get a chemical, you got to check on where your source is from. What and is your source? Is your sub supplier providing you chemicals that are developed in a safe way? And there were all sorts of interesting things going on that I thought were Section 6 candidates. But I think when the new crowd came in, all they could think about how we get these regulations out. I think the general counsel office sort of took charge. There were some deadlines in TSCA, as I recall. You had to have the inventory out in 2 years or something.
There were very few deadlines, but there were one or two, and I think the inventory was one of them.
Was the testing?
There might have been, I'd have to go back and check, but definitely the inventory and questions around PCBs, and but pretty limited.
Well, once they start, everybody's an expert in writing regulations. Everybody wants to be a hero, write the regulations. And I experienced that with the CFC regulations. So my attitude is always let somebody else write it, and then we can just edit it. They can put their name as the author. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But now the big worry I have is whether we're going to try to amend TSCA for the sake of amending TSCA rather than because it needs it. And I heard two rationales given at the meeting the other day. One was TSCA hasn't been amended in 35 years, and it's the only major piece of legislation we have that hasn't been amended. That sounds to me amending for amending's sake. And secondly, this industry wants stability. I don't know what that means. If you've heard those arguments too.
I think the first is pretty prominent. And the second, I think, is a common one in most regulatory circles. Just if you think there's reform in the air, you want to get that reform out of the way, right?
It's like the uncertainty when the thing was proposed in the first place.
Right. So they would like reform to happen sooner rather than later.
If it's going to happen.
Right, so it adds stability back to the market.
But they aren't saying that it ought to be reformed this way.
They certainly have their principles for reform, and I think they have the things that they want to be reformed. I think where you're getting at with some of your questions, though, get at the larger problems that we've been interested in highlighting, which are, is it the statute that needs to be fixed, or is it the ways in which the statute has been implemented that need to be fixed? And those require very different solutions. Some of that's wording, and there are certainly wording issues that folks might want to shore up. There's certainly larger situations in thinking about chemical hazard and chemical control that have emerged over the last 35 years that perhaps couldn't have been thought of. But there's also a lot that folks have pointed to in these discussions that say the tools are there. What needs to be fixed is the ways in which you use them. And I think, you know, the comment you just had about the current assistant administrator, Steve Owens, talking about we're trying to go back and use some of these tools that we haven't thought about using for the last 20 years. They're still there. We just haven't thought about using them. And figuring out a way that if you're going to do reform, you reform the correct things is crucially important.
But the big message from this whole legislation was that the EPA has to, APA or the U.S. government has to look at chemicals in the full context of that. If that chemical has 15 different uses, you got to look at them all as a lump. And this was to be get people out of the smokestacks. That was sort of the idea. But I'm afraid that I'm interested to find out whether it's that worked and why. Is it just too bureaucratically complicated? So that's it.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Was that helpful?